Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, April 19th, and this is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning, Steve.
And joining us later will be Landry Harlan from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner and Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now a look at some of the news here around the Cape and the islands. Gwen, the towns of Dennis and Yarmouth have been involved in contention over the regional school district. And the inciting factor here is a proposal for a new joint middle school and the state's willingness to put up money for construction. But the two towns must agree on how they split costs in the district. And there's a lawsuit. Let's start with the news that the deadline for signing the commitment on the new school has been pushed back.
It has. The state has agreed that instead of April 11th, which was the initial deadline, that they will go to, I believe it's June 30th. Let me just double check here. Yes, it's been extended until June 30th, which is good news for the towns as they try to build this $117 million school, but also means that a lot of things have to happen in the next 2 weeks or so.
Quite a lot of things. So the cost of the school, it's a new middle school, which will really essentially replace two middle schools, one that's in Dennis and one that's in Yarmouth now. And the cost of the new school, as you say, is $117 million. The state has said it will put up a little more than $44 million toward this construction cost. But the two towns have to sign a letter of commitment on this new project. And that's what this deadline was all about. The deadline to sign it was last week, April 11th. And as you say, it's been extended now until June. And both the towns asked for this extension.
They did, because they still want to build the school. But the elephant in the room here is that Yarmouth has a lawsuit pending against Dennis, because the contention is that the school committee didn't have the right to make this decision, that had to go to town meeting in each of the towns. And that is happening now. But that's not simple either, because in the meantime, the state has said that it doesn't have time to review the entire proposed agreement that is going before town meeting voters. So they're asking that the two towns just look at a section of that, a part of that, and it's a part that has to do with finances.
Mm-hmm.
It's there's a don't mean to stutter on you,
no.
But there is a there's a change, a big change in how the not only this school but how the district would be financed if this passes, and that's kind of like a central point here in all of the changes that are proposed.
So even this new middle school, the decision to move forward to it came out of an election that was held last year, I think early in December. And it was decided by just 25 votes between the two towns, Dennis voting in favor of moving ahead on the new school, Yarmouth actually voting against it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Yarmouth then filed this lawsuit saying, we should never have had this election in this way. It should have been decided by town meeting.
Right.
And many are seeing that lawsuit as perhaps being not so much about the new school, but about an effort to renegotiate the regional agreement between these two towns, Dennis and Yarmouth. And Yarmouth wanting to Dennis to carry a bigger share of the costs of these two schools,
right,
of the combined district.
Right now, Dennis is paying a per-pupil cost.
Mm-hmm.
But what Yarmouth is looking for is to have them pay more of the operating expenses as well. And we do have the stories that we've been doing do have a breakdown on exactly how much that is. It's like graduated coming, you know, starting at, I'm just looking for numbers here. It's graduated starting at a smaller amount and then moving up.
It's going to end up at about 35% and 65%. Dennis paying 35% of the cost and Yarmouth paying 65%.
Right, I think it starts out at 28%, you know, for Dennis.
And the question then is that'll become a fixed percentage for the two districts. And Dennis feeling like they send fewer kids to this district, they are being asked to carry a bigger portion of the costs. And also, I think some in Dennis feeling that right now with Yarmouth hanging this lawsuit out there, that it's been a bit of arm twisting to try to, you know, to some leverage that they're looking to get in this negotiation. Yarmouth is by suing the school committee.
And that brings us into the second story we had this week on the same topic. And that is that Yarmouth has offered to drop the lawsuit if the proposal passes the Dennis town meeting. But that's, as you say, kind of an arm-twisting way to go into town meeting. And some of the folks in Dennis are feeling that that's really pretty unfair to frame it in that way. So as I said at the start of this, there's a lot of complicated things coming up because the two town meetings are coming up. And in order to sign that letter with the state, they have to have the town meeting approval, but they also have to have that lawsuit dispensed with because the state won't enter into a contract if the lawsuit is still on the table. So,
and Yarmouth says it will drop it if both town meetings accept this, but both town meetings, even in the last couple of weeks, it's sort of changed what they're being asked to accept. At first, it was a whole new regional agreement, and now they're asking the town meetings just to examine that portion of the regional agreement that has to do with splitting costs here.
And the issue with that is that the warrants are already printed, the town business warrants. I think most people know that town after all this years. But so they would have to amend this from the floor of town meeting, which means it won't be right in front of people.
So a lot of moving parts here, town meetings coming up in the two towns, and really this new middle school hanging in the balance here, the school superintendent saying, kind of pointing back to this, saying that really what's at stake here is a new middle school and the state's willingness to put up the $44 million to the cost of construction. If none of this comes together, they're going to lose a great opportunity.
But, you know, Dennis, some folks in Dennis are still saying, yes, that's the big thing right in front of us, but we are also talking about an institutional change in our funding mechanism.
We're going to speak right now with Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Landry.
Good morning, Steve.
Landry, a couple of weeks ago on the Roundup, we talked about the effort on the island to start a housing bank using a portion of the funds from the new short-term rental tax. And this was to address the problem of affordable year-round housing on the island. Now, each of the island town meetings were to take up this issue, and now three of the town meetings have been held with two more still to come. Catch us up on the state of the housing bank issue.
Right. So there's actually four town meetings last week, all on one night. It's our biggest political night on the island, and this is the biggest issue. Conversations ran late into the night. Some of the meetings went into several days. But in the end, three of the towns voted down the housing bank. Only one approved of it. And now it's kind of on life support heading into two town meetings coming up in the next few weeks, and it needs three towns to approve to move forward as a home rule petition. And I spoke with some of the leaders of one of the towns, Chilmark, that's having a meeting next week, and they disapprove of the proposal, and so does their financial committee. So it's not looking likely, but there's still a chance next week that it could go through.
Can you tell us how the towns voted?
Yes. So Tisbury, Edgartown, and Oak Bluffs voted it down pretty soundly, too. It wasn't too close. But West Tisbury actually voted to approve it, but only half of it. You see, there's actually two articles that are part of it, one that establishes the housing bank and one to establish a funding mechanism. After a lot of discussion, really late into the night, they voted for the first half, establishing the bank. But as it was getting to the late hour, everyone said, you know what, I can't talk about this much longer. Let's push the second part of this to a meeting. It's going to happen later this month. So it's still kind of in doubt if the entire thing is going to get passed by West Tisbury.
And what were the main concerns of the towns here? Explain for us.
Right. So kind of the opponents of the proposal say that this really needs more detail. And there's lots of mechanisms in towns already to address the affordable housing issue. And there just needs to be more conversation. Because the people who are trying to get this passed, it was kind of a pretty quick turnaround. And their argument is this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity because of this recently passed short-term rentals tax. They want to use 50% of funds collected by that from the very lucrative vineyard rental market to get this bank going. But it's a very fast-moving process, and some say, you know, that's a little bit too fast and want a little bit more detail before they move forward.
You can imagine there would be questions about what qualifies as year-round housing, affordable housing, and how that's sort of put together, the whole bank. Are those the details that need to be figured out?
Actually, yes. So it's interesting. The word affordable doesn't even appear in the petition. And the proponents of this explained this a bit in the meetings, that they didn't want to limit it to just kind of one definition, that sometimes, you know, there's a fire chief or someone in a town who doesn't really fall into the definition of needing affordable housing, but is still an important part of the town who needs help to pay for housing. So they didn't want to limit it. But I know some people on Island have felt that, no, we need to really just limit that to affordable, because that's our biggest issue on Island. And that'll likely be a big topic of discussion for future meetings to discuss this proposal.
So two Up Island town meetings still to come. And is there any sense of how they're going to address the issue?
Yes. So they're both on the warrants, and Chilmark is looking to lean towards no. And Aquinnah, it's kind of up in the air right now, but the proponents of the proposal met earlier this week, and they're really bringing everyone who's on the team to these meetings to push for it. So maybe they'll be able to convince the town to do it. It's kind of up in the air, and it's a lot of drama heading into next week, as they need one more town to make this go through.
Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette. Landry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times is with me. Gwen, we are now entering the second week of a strike at Stop and Shop supermarkets. It's a challenge for shoppers in many places, particularly on Nantucket and Provincetown, where Stop and Shop really represents the only supermarket option. In other places, there are other options for a supermarket, and those stores have been doing very well.
They have. They're seeing crowds that are almost like summer crowds, you know, the competing stores. And the strikers have had a... it's actually the United Food and Commercial Workers Local 328. They've had a big presence outside the stores, and people seem to be respecting their wishes to not cross the strike line. One of the people that we talked to, Orleans Stop and Shop meat cutter Richard Wright, said that he's a strike captain. He said that they don't mind if people go in for the bank or the pharmacy, but they, you know, asking them not to grocery shop while the strike is ongoing. And we hadn't talked about it yet, but at issue with the strike is that the new contract that's on the table would increase the amount that employees pay for their share of medical insurance premiums, and would also decrease for new workers the amount of pension that they would accrue. And there's also Wright was saying that one thing that upsets him the most is the idea of eliminating time and a half on Sundays.
Just to give folks a sense of the scope of this, there are 16 Stop and Shops across the Cape and the islands, and another 3 or 4 on the South Coast. So this is a major, major player in the supermarket world for folks here.
It really is. You know, you can almost chart them in your mind as you're driving past. And I did want to take a minute, which is an aside to this story, mm-hmm. but on CapeCodTimes.com/video, I believe it's still there. There was one unusual thing that happened on the strike line in Hyannis this week, and that was that two people who both work there, he got down on a knee and took a knee and proposed to her. She said yes, and it's all on video. It's kind of a nice break.
And he's wearing a kind of a strike sign around his neck, but it says, I think, "Will you marry me?"
Will you marry me? That's right. So it was a fun little aside.
We're going to talk a little bit more about this story later in the program with Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Provincetown, because of its dependence on a single supermarket, has a particular stake on this situation. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Gwen Friss. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking more with Gwen and check in with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. There's more in a moment. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Gwen, for years now, researchers have been focused on studying sharks along the Outer Cape on the Atlantic side. But as great white sharks seem to be extending their range, researchers will be extending their range too, because there have been more and more shark sightings in Cape Cod Bay.
There have been, and dramatic shark sightings. We spoke to Doug Frazier, spoke to Captain Hap Farrell, who's a charter fishing boat out of Rock Harbor, and for close to 40 years. And he was telling stories of sport fishermen he takes out, they've actually had fish taken off their lines by juvenile great white sharks, which is a heck of a story. You might not get a fish, but boy, that's a story that'll last a lifetime. So in the wake of that and other stories like it, Gregory Scommel, who is a shark researcher with the State Division of Marine Fisheries and well-known down here, has said that he'll make at least 10 trips into the other side of the bay this year. And what they're going to be doing is they'll have the spotter planes up first, mm-hmm. and if they find, using those and the app that they have to track sharks, if they find that they're seeing sharks that are not tagged yet, Mr. Scommel will go out and tag them, because they've been doing this for quite a few years, and now they can actually, they all have names. We have a website where you can visit each of them, but they'll be able to increase their Sharktivity, that's the name of the app, their Sharktivity app, and know which sharks are in the area.
Now, it sounds like a lot of the sharks in Cape Cod Bay are young sharks, juvenile sharks. So
that's
these
right.
are not the full-grown great whites, but they might be 8 to 12 feet, which is still a substantial fish.
Yes, and with a lot of teeth.
And these are mostly feeding on striped bass is what they think is drawing them there, food mm-hmm. for the young sharks. But one of the things that Greg points out in this article, which I found interesting, is that the young sharks may be congregating there into what they call a kind of a nursery because they're away from the bigger sharks that are on the outer side of the Cape, and because the bigger sharks actually will eat younger sharks. They have an appetite for them. So this is in some ways where the younger sharks come here to feed in Cape Cod Bay, and they've been seeing more and more numbers of them. And the captain, Captain Farrell, that you mentioned earlier, was saying that fishing now in Cape Cod Bay has changed because when you bring a striped bass into the boat, if you've been out striped bass fishing, you want to be very careful about putting your hands in the water to grab that fish.
Yes,
because
that's
the
what
sharks
I was mentioning
can be coming
about
right
the,
under the boat.
He tells a couple of stories, one about someone who was bringing in a fish and one of the young sharks got a bite of it and took half of it and then came back to get the rest, you know. So they may be young, but they're pretty persistent, and you don't want to be dragging your hand outside that boat.
And Captain Farrell also says that, as you mentioned, the customers kind of like the fact that there's this shark thrill that goes along with fishing in Cape Cod Bay these days. It's not a drawback for them.
Yes, so.
The company that wants to decommission Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, which is scheduled to close at the end of May, has announced it's looking to decommission another nuclear plant in New York. And there are a lot of questions about this company and the process and how much it can handle and how it's all going to get paid for.
Holtec International is the company that we're talking about, and they are planning to buy Indian Point Energy Center in New York. That's a 3-reactor site. And what they have to do at all of the sites that they buy is to secure the spent fuel rods on site, to disassemble the infrastructure, the buildings, and that kind of thing, and clean up any waste that has been accumulated over the years, and then to make sure that there's a secure storage until the federal nuclear regulatory folks go ahead and build a central storage place. So this has to happen for each of the sites, and people are saying that they're very concerned because Holtec hasn't done this before. They're sort of jumping in and starting a collaborative, if you will, without having done it before. I think there was an interesting comment in the story from someone who said, this is a Plymouth businessman, Sean Mullen, said, quote, "I don't want Holtec to learn how to shave on our beard."
A very good comment. Sean Mullen, who's also the chairman of the Nuclear Decommissioning Citizens Advisory Panel.
Right.
So he's...
Mm-hmm, that's Sean. So the other thing is that Holtec is promising an 8-year turnaround for these projects. And when Entergy, the owners, predicted how long it would take to clean and close the plant, they had 60 years. So there's some concerns about those indiscrepancies, as well as who will as you said, whether the funding will be steady for all of these projects.
Now, the plant has what's called a trust fund associated with it. It's a decommissioning fund that ratepayers have been paying into for the life of the plant now for 40-plus years, and it's over $1 billion. And this is really, some say this is the draw for a company like Holtec. They have this big pot of money sitting there, and if they can decommission it for less than that, then that they can take what's left, apparently, as their profit. But the concern here is that actually not having done this before as a company, and this not having happened before, there's no telling how much this is going to cost, really. And there are concerns about contamination at the plant. And the Attorney General of Massachusetts, Mara Healey, has gotten involved, saying that essentially taxpayers are going to be left on the hook if this cost overruns $1 billion. And what happens? There's no provisions in this contract for what happens if that overruns.
And if this company goes under or pulls out, mm-hmm. you know, that's a concern. This new round of concerns included the idea that if they add three reactors in New York, what does that mean? Is that going to draw from the resources that are allocated to the plant in Plymouth? And the company spokesman said that they will have a dedicated staff at each of the decommissioned sites, and it'll include people who are working there now, and also managers that are being brought in by Holtec.
And Holtec's saying there's some benefits to scale. If they're doing a number of these plants, they can take what they're calling a fleet approach to decommissioning all these plants.
But with the individual teams.
They're
reassuring on both sides.
We're going to speak right now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve. Good morning, Gwen.
Good morning.
Ed, a little earlier we were talking about how the strike by Stop and Shop workers has affected portions of the Cape, but really Nantucket and Provincetown represent extreme cases in that Stop and Shop is really the only major supermarket there. You've got an article about how people are responding in Provincetown, and it reflects, I think, some of the very strong sense of community that Provincetown has.
Well, that's exactly right. Stop and Shop is the only real supermarket between here and Orleans, which is Orleans is about 27 miles away, about a 40-minute drive. So when the workers at the Provincetown Stop and Shop walked off the job last Thursday, the 11th, it really, I think, was a question. You know, are people going to respect the picket line? And they have to a remarkable extent. The Stop and Shop workers here have been extraordinarily amazed, really, and grateful at how much support they have received. Not just in people respecting the line, but in supporting them in other ways. Bringing them food,
plenty of food. It sounds like.
Yeah, really. The Linda Jodko Stewart, who is one of the union stewards here in Provincetown, said that we are well fed. She said they've been getting coffee, soup, sandwiches, and pizza. Lots of pizza. We go home at the end of the night and don't have to think about dinner because we are full from the day. She said. But even more than that, the business community here in Provincetown has been supportive of the workers. So on Monday, when there was a downpour, Liz Lovati, who is a local business person, runs Liz's Cafe, brought each striker a poncho to keep them dry. Mm-hmm. Robert Enos, who is the owner of J&E Fruit and Produce here, which is a family-owned wholesaler, has opened their doors to the public by offering boxed groceries for pickup. And Raphael Richter, who is the owner of Cape Cab and the Funk Bus, has been offering a free shuttle service to Orleans to bring people to one of the other grocery stores there. There's a Shaw's and the Friends Marketplace in Orleans.
So this is really unique. Tell us about the free shuttle service and how they plan to make it work.
Well, you have to call the Cape Cab and make a reservation, but they will save a spot for you in one of their vans and take you to Orleans. You get 1 hour to shop, and then they bring you back to Provincetown free of charge. Richter, the owner of the service, said, we're offering this free shuttle service once a day so folks have access to groceries. We want to support the community and also support the Stop and Shop workers. And he points out that it's we live in a partial food desert out here with really just one grocery store. So it's been a really interesting story. Linda Jodko-Stewart, the union steward, says every day people are dropping stuff off, donating things. She says it's so Provincetown.
I was impressed that there were 80 people employed at the Provincetown Stop and Shop. This is a big employer there.
It is. It's a major employer in a town with fewer than 3,000 people. And, you know, the workers, I believe, have been going without any pay. I think that the union, that's the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union, says that it will compensate the workers $100 per week, but I think that doesn't even start until after the strike has been going for 2 weeks. It's now, I think, in its ninth day. And I stopped and talked to some of the workers this morning, and they're obviously feeling the stress, clearly. They're wishing that this strike were over. But they're extremely grateful to the community, and they point out also that they have no problem with people crossing the line to go into the store if they need to get a prescription at the pharmacy, or if they're just elderly shoppers who need food. They're totally supportive of that. But they're hanging in there.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Great to be with you.
Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times is with me. And Gwen, the state's Department of Environmental Protection is putting together new regulations for contaminants in drinking water.
We are back to PFAS. I haven't about PFAS in quite a while, but that is per- and polyfluoroalkyl. Okay.
I couldn't pronounce it, but I know that it's contaminants that come from typically come from firefighting foams, oftentimes.
Yes.
And they're contaminants of emerging concern. So the Department of Environmental Protection is saying we need to be looking at this more carefully.
There, you know, those contaminants already had a limit. It was 70 parts per million.
Trillion.
Per trillion. Oh, goodness. Yes. You don't see that number very often.
Not too often.
Which seems tiny, but in the world of water quality standards, the state is looking at making it tighter, going from 70 to 20 parts per trillion. And it's interesting that Barnstable and Mashpee, because they have had pollution from firefighting foam from the Practice Academy where it was used, they're already looking at this and maybe a bit ahead of the curve on the state's proposals, because they're already looking at managing their drinking water based on the cleanup that they have to do. So.
This is a proposed regulation, so DEP is putting this forward, saying this is where we think we're headed. And these towns are trying, you mentioned both Hyannis and Mashpee, they're trying to be proactive in making sure they're not caught when this becomes a regulation, kind of flat-footed.
Right. Yeah,
they want to be
not,
prepared for this.
This is not overnight. And like I said, it's been front and center for them because of the testing and they've done on their sites. We should mention, because perhaps we didn't, that, you know, you get to thinking everybody knows this, but the concern is cancer-causing. And that's for a lot of the contaminants, but these fall into that category that it would tend to... they rarely say cause, but be a factor in cancer.
And Mashpee has already been juggling its water supply to sort of work its way around. There's one of its wells, at least one, that was taken offline because it had, I think, 35 parts per trillion. So, and what I thought was interesting here was that Mashpee has actually been buying or is set up to buy water for this summer. That's what it is. And they're going to buy 100 million gallons of water this summer from the Upper Cape Water Collaborative, which is on Joint Base Cape Cod.
Right, and because they have a second well down as well, mm-hmm. so two of their seven okay. are down.
Two out of seven.
And they did bring that down at 30. They took it offline at 35 parts per trillion rather than letting it go to the 70 as the standard now exists.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Gwen Friss. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we're going to speak with Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. With me from the Cape Cod Times is Gwen Friss. Gwen, the Steamship Authority Ferry Line is adding to its management team, and this is in part a response to the troubles it had last year, which resulted in an independent review of its operations.
And that review, maybe I should say that those troubles, included three vessel blackouts, which left people, sitting on the ferry in the water, a grounding, and hundreds of trip cancellations. Folks, especially on the island, said that we can't live with this. This is not doable for us. So they brought in the ferry, the steamship, the Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket Steamship Authority. Brought in a consultant called HMS, and the consultant made several recommendations, including creating two new positions and filling two that already existed. They found that a big part of the problem was there was no uniformity in how regulations were set out and enforced amongst the different ferries. So the captain was kind of just running it, and there wasn't any oversight. So. What the people who are new in the position in these newly created positions are Angela Sampson. She is in the position with health, safety, and environmental monitoring, and she's worked for more than a decade in that field with companies including Celebrity Cruises and also with the toy company Hasbro. So. The second person who is stepping in this newly created position, he as director of marine operations, is Mark Amundson, and he was most recently served as operations manager for Singapore Technologies Marine, and that was running ferries in Europe.
Hmm. And they also have, and those are the two new positions. They're
right.
also filling positions that have been vacant for a little bit in human resources and port captain, I
right.
believe.
Mm-hmm.
And the port captain is coming, somebody who's a fifth generation Martha's Vineyard Islander.
Yes. Jordan Baptiste.
We're going to step right now to Brittany Bowker, who's on the phone with us from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Brittany.
Morning, Steve.
Brittany, you've got a powerful article this week that you reported, and it's about the opioid epidemic and how it's affecting the island. And one of the things that it does, I think, that's so strong is that it really focuses on some of the people, and the families, the parents, and the children caught up in this. And it does this while examining the bigger picture. Tell us about this.
Yeah, sure. So just to give you some background, recent data was gathered by an island health administrator that showed that the number of drug-related deaths doubled on the island in 1 year. There were three fatal overdoses in 2017, six in 2018, and there are cases that are still pending, so that number could be even larger. And all this information is being gathered at the beginning of 2019, and there's already some general knowledge of several other recent island deaths being linked to overdoses. And so I reached out to one of the families I had heard was affected, and Kathy and Andy Farisi lost their 27-year-old son, Will, to a fentanyl overdose this past January. Will's battle began 15 years ago, and it began, like so many others, with a prescription. And Will was an amputee. He lost his leg in a childhood injury, and that's when he was first prescribed OxyContin. His addiction began with that prescription, eventually led to heroin, fentanyl, and eventually his death. So it was a really heartbreaking story that I truly commend the Farisees for telling. They said that if it can help other families going through similar situations, then it's worth it. And it's a story like this that puts a face to the issue, especially in a small community like this one. Their story speaks volumes over statistics and numbers on a chart. So I do commend the Farisees for their strength and openness.
Brittany, you mentioned that drug overdoses doubled on the island over the past year, and this is not for a lack of effort to combat the epidemic.
Right. There's tons of groups on the island who are there. There's tons of resources available. The Martha's Vineyard Community Services is available, tons of meetings. So, I mean, the story led to some interesting conversations. I spoke with a police lieutenant in Oak Bluffs who said that law enforcement is doing everything that they can, but it's hard to fight the fight because they sort of have one hand tied behind their back. The Fourth Amendment, they can't search people without probable cause. The island has a number of small-time dealers, so they're not bringing large quantities to the island. And so that, you know, that puts a real barrier with law enforcement trying to crack down on this.
I think one of the police officers in your story was speaking about an effort underway to more strongly prosecute some of the people selling these drugs, and he talks about it as accountability.
Right, yeah, holding dealers more accountable. Maybe there are some communities in New Hampshire I know that have started charging dealers with manslaughter charges, and that might have more of a deterrent effect on dealers and may prevent some of this from happening on the island. So implementing more of that, this officer said, might help the issue.
Brittany, your article closes with a list of island resources. Tell me about that.
Right. So there's a number of island resources that people can utilize. The Martha's Vineyard Community Services has many outlets for families and individuals struggling. There's also the Martha's Vineyard Hospital has a substance use disorder department. There's Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. There's the Vineyard House. And if you go to the website and look at this list, there's at least a dozen resources for people who are struggling with this issue to reach out to.
Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Brittany, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
With me in the studio is Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, a member of the Dennis Yarmouth School Committee, used her district email improperly, sending a message that she later had to apologize for. Explain what happened here.
Andrea St. Germain said that she, quote, "I did it inadvertently." And what it is sending a message that was about a documentary called Unplanned, which tells the story of a former Planned Parenthood clinic director turned anti-abortion activist. We know that at least 13 people received the message. There may have been more. They haven't tracked that yet. St. Germain said that she thought she was using her personal email, that she would never do that as a district member, but it went out over her school email, you know.
And the people who received this, or a number of the people who received this, were very concerned that this was coming from a school district email.
They were. In particular, Kim Berner went to the head of the school committee and said, you know, this is objectionable, this doesn't belong here. And the chairwoman of the school committee, Jenny Landers, spoke with St. Germain and said that she was told that it was just an error, a technical error, and that St. Germain apologized and wouldn't do it again. But it did raise some concerns amongst people who felt this was an inappropriate subject.
Mm. And the district has said it's going to be looking at some of its policies around email use on their email addresses there.
Right.
The state has approved power contracts for the offshore wind company Vineyard Wind. This is kind of a final sign-off on a deal that was reached last year, and it represents a big hurdle cleared for the company.
It does. I have to tell you, Steve, that in my mind, it helps me to sort of picture this whole process, and then I can see which piece of it this is. But so, starting with our Lego explanation here.
Okay.
I make light, but seriously, there are a lot of pieces that have to be in place in order for the project to go forward. It would be 84 wind turbines. It would be the largest wind farm in the United States. And the piece that was just completed and is critical to construction beginning this year involves approving the contracts between Vineyard Wind and the Stop looking. You're looking at me like I'm going to get this wrong.
No, you're getting it right. I'm enjoying your explanation.
Between Vineyard Wind and the electrical distributors, you know, the turbines are out there being powered by the wind, getting all this power. They have to get it to the people who are going to use it. So, so this particular approval from the state takes care of those contracts that they have people who will take the power, electrical distribution companies. So there is another piece that still is outstanding and needs to be resolved before construction can begin. And that that is an approval for Vineyard Wind's plan to land its high-voltage cable on the southern coast of Barnstable. So that there's a couple of groups working on that. The State's Energy Facilities Siting Board, which had been planning a decision by March 1st, is now looking at early May, and the board is expected to meet May 9th in Boston. In the meantime, the Cape Cod Commission, which gets involved with projects of regional developments of regional impact, has continued until May 2nd its public hearing on the review of the cable lane. So there's more pieces to come, but this one that approved the electric distribution lines that
and
was
the power
a big
contracts.
One.
Yes,
right.
A big deal here for the company, which is trying to move forward because it's really trying to take advantage of these tax credits, which are available to it only until the end of this year, and which I think are a big part of their scheme to make all these pieces come together in a way that they can sell the power at a reduced price to people and also still be profitable.
And I think they're also they have a fund set up to create opportunities for batteries to store the power when it's produced, particularly in lower income communities. And in just to give you a sense of how much money this is, the wind farm would be a $2 billion proposition.
Today marks the deadline for comment on the utility company Eversource's latest plan for managing growth under its power lines. It's a plan that includes the use of herbicides, and that's been a source of long-running contention between the utility and residents in towns.
And it is again this year. The herbicide, the particular component folks are concerned about is glyphosate. You may have heard of it in connection with the brand Rodeo, and that's what Eversource uses to treat poison ivy, vines, and invasive species. Glyphosate is the chemical of concern because it has been listed as a probable carcinogen causing cancer. This spraying, this treatment, includes Barnstable, Bourne, Chatham, Dennis, Eastham, Falmouth, Harwich, Mashpee, Orleans, Sandwich, Truro, Wellfleet, and Yarmouth, just about all of the towns. The company responds that it's responsible for less than 1% of total herbicide use on Cape Cod. And it also points out that glyphosate is a very small percentage of the herbicide that it's using, So, however, this has been a yearly and annual right, the protest, and at the forefront is Laura Kelly, who's president of Protect Our Cape Cod Aquifer. And she says that officials in every Barnstable County town have submitted letters opposing the use of herbicides with glyphosate. Her group has been working on having the chemical banned altogether by a local ban, by a town-by-town ban. And the Cape's legislative delegation is also working to curb pesticide and herbicide use.
This is, as you say, it's been an issue that has been going on for a long time, and it seems like the opportunity to try to get the towns to ban these through regulation is really where the push is coming.
It is, and I think specifically around glyphosate because of the regulators' status on it, you know. So,
I want to take a moment here to remember Rob Sennett, who died on Wednesday. Rob was a longtime fixture in the Cape Cod journalism world. as he was owner and publisher of the Barnstable Patriot for many years. And we knew Rob here at WCAI, where he served for a short period as managing director after he sold the Patriot. And Rob was a big presence. He had a great deep voice and a wonderful laugh. And he was a fabulous dresser. He was probably much too nicely dressed for public radio. And he was a great positive presence here at the station. He was also known on the Cape for his volunteer work. He was involved in many organizations, including the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod, the Cape Symphony, and the John F. Kennedy Museum. And he was a force in the revitalization of Hyannis. And Rob Sennett had a great enjoyment for life. And we send our thoughts to his wife, Tony, and his son, Tim. And he will be missed.
I have to tell you, Steve, I didn't know Rob well, but whenever I saw him, the thing that I always remembered, he says, a very firm and yet warm handshake.
He was a great person to be around. I used to work late doing All Things Considered here, and he would often come into the newsroom after everyone was gone just to talk, and he had some great stories of publishing in New York City.
I was sad to see that in today's paper.
Let's touch on one more story here. The Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe is developing affordable housing for tribe members, and this project has been a long time in the works, but the first phase of housing is almost completed.
And there are plans to have a lottery to find out who will be able to get these first units. It will be called the First Light Wampanoag Homes Development, and it's located at 184 Meeting House Road. It's a 42-unit low-income housing project subsidized by the Massachusetts Department of Housing and Economic Development. In December 2017, the state announced $1 million in funding for the project that would come in the form of state and federal tax credits, which totaled close to $11 million equity and support, according to the tribe's press release.
And as you say, the tribe is having a lottery to put people into these houses. It's really an attempt to address a dire housing need among the tribe, as it says.
Yes, and I think we should mention that the spokesman for the tribe said, and I think that it was well known, that this project was sort of the heart child of Alice Lopez. And she was the housing department's maiden director, and she passed away in 2011 at age 49 from a blood clot. And she was really instrumental in getting this project off the ground.
Gwen, we have just about a minute here. I want to ask you about your own Facebook Live program that airs each week. It's called Life with Gwen. And last week you had on there a voice and a person well known to us here at WCAI. Sean Corcoran, our former news director, was with you along with Greg O'Brien.
That's right. And, you know, I think we love it, all of our guests, and find that there's a niche for each of them. But I think this is a topic that really gets to our demographic, because Greg O'Brien has been living for 9 years with early onset Alzheimer's disease. And he came with the message that, you know, you don't get diagnosed and die. You have a long life, and it's not just a disease of older people. About 200,000 of the 5.5 million who have been diagnosed in this country are early onset people, you know, like Greg, who got the disease at age 59. So there is now a podcast that Greg is doing with David Schenck, and together they're sort of tracking Greg's progress. It started about 18 months ago. They're also bringing in voices, bringing in people who are researching Alzheimer's.
And the podcast is called The Forgetting. You can find it right here on our website at capeandislands.org. That's our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Gwen Friss from the Cape Cod Times. Gwen, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
And I want to thank our other contributors. We spoke to Landry Harlan at the Vineyard Gazette, Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, and Brittany Bowker at the Martha's Vineyard Times. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.